Aruba, Jamaica, ooh, I wanna take you to Bermuda, Bahama, come on, pretty mama, Key Largo. Hello, welcome to the Podfather. I'm Jordan.
I'm Alex.
And
wow.
Today we are talking about Key Largo.
What an intro.
Yes, there you go.
You know, the funny thing is, as soon as you started singing that, I was like, oh, I bet you they mentioned Key Largo in that song.
Yep.
So I never even considered that.
Yeah, that's all I thought about the whole movie.
Good job.
It was the Beach Boys. We're talking about Key Largo today, but before we get to that, we've got a bit of listener feedback.
Couple of bits of listener feedback. Firstly, listener Dylan wanted to let us know that he loves the podcast. So, hey, Dylan, if you're listening.
G'day, Dylan.
Thanks for listening. And, you know, like I said to you, we'll be fortnightly now in your ears. So every second Monday, if all goes well, keep sending us the feedback and the love. And then we also received a nice comment from Eliza.
That's true.
She's one of your friends.
Absolutely.
Now, she's the person that we bumped into on the train that time, right?
No, that's Lizzie.
That's Lizzie. Sorry, Eliza. It's not you. But if you want to come on the show, let us know, because you said in our lovely review of The Joker we said that you shouldn't watch The Joker, you should just watch You Never Really Hear. And you agreed with that, having not even seen The Joker. So props to you for listening to the podcast without seeing the movie. So that's great.
Yes. Particularly today, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably haven't seen Key Largo. So
I don't think
thank you.
Gonna watch it. Yeah. You want us to do an episode on You Will Never Really Hear. So we will. We'll listen to our listeners. And if you want to hop on it or send us some comments, feel free. Where the door's open.
The door is open. Now, speaking of Lizzie, who we saw on the train that one time.
That Lizzie.
Lizzie Brennan.
Yeah.
My good friend, has also sent us a message.
Oh, you're joking.
Just this morning.
No.
Funnily enough, congratulating us on the revamp and very pleased that we're back.
Oh.
So thank you, Lizzie.
Thank you, Lizzie and Eliza and Dylan. Top listeners.
Now, was there any other follow-up?
Not that I can think of. I feel like there was a little
Just that since we recorded Joker, Jonah Hill is no longer involved in The Batman.
That's right. That's what I was going to say.
Paul Dano.
Our friend, Paul Dano.
The great Paul Dano.
He's going to be the Riddler.
So that's the only sort of...
There you go, everyone.
...correction that I needed to,
the Batman
to put
corner.
Out there.
Batman corner of... you know, maybe we'll do the new Batman as well.
Well, we absolutely will. That's who we are now. All right, biscuit time.
Yes.
Time for another Arnott's biscuit.
Before you bring it out,
yeah.
You've been uploading some milk reviews, actually.
I have.
Uploading some milk to great reception.
To the Facebook. Yes.
Yeah. You did the Ice Vovo drink.
Yep.
The mint slice drink.
Yep.
I think I actually didn't watch one of them yet. Sorry.
That's all right.
I think they're fantastic.
Thank you. You should do the same. If you ever try, not the biscuits, keep the biscuits for here, but any other Arnott's specialty products.
Well, you know, it got me thinking.
Start uploading them.
Because you mentioned in an episode that hasn't actually aired, that we should bring back the videos.
Oh, yes.
I liked what you've done with the videos of the milk. So I think that we should, even if we end up just filming a quick little eating video after or before the podcast, we will
idea.
Provide some more supplementary content, I think.
I think that's a good idea.
To this. That can just hop up on the Facebook and stuff so people can see the biscuits and not listen to the show because that's what they really want.
I think doing it on the iPhone like I did...
No one cares anymore.
It's such low production value as to be fine. It's not the medium production value that we were talking about. So anyway, yeah, stay tuned, listeners. If you love biscuits, make sure you follow us on Facebook.
Because, yeah, we'll do something.
We're going to do some more Arnott's content and possibly some more, you know, crime movie content too.
Maybe.
We'll see.
We do superhero movies. We do biscuits. That's it.
But today, we're actually returning to our old form.
Yes.
And we'll talk about that a little bit more. But first, it's time to talk about biscuits.
Yeah, it's Arnott's time.
Woo! All right. This is a classic, and I did talk about it as one of my favorite movie snacks.
Half-coated tiny teddies.
Half-coated.
Joyous.
Milk chocolate. Arnott's tiny teddies. Meet them. Then eat them.
Do you remember you used to get like a packet? I mean, okay, just quickly, you should listen to the podcast for the Biscuit Corner because we go into incredible detail about the history of Arnott's and biscuits and our you know, experiences as children.
It is
good content. Do you remember you used to get like the big packets that had the mini packets and then there were like four plain, four milk chocolate and
the chocolate chip ones.
The chocolate chip
and the honey ones.
And
the plain ones, yeah.
I always had a love-hate relationship with the honey ones.
Yeah, they were they're the strawberry. They're to the rest of the tiny teddies what strawberry is to the rest of the Neapolitan ice cream.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate, actually.
Because they're left in the packet. But these ones are the half-coated in milk chocolate ones.
I think these are the best.
Now, even without tasting these, I know that as soon as I put it in my mouth, I'm going to think of Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh,
because
really?
I had a packet of these during that movie for the first time that I brought these into a cinema. And now every time I eat them, I think about that that wonderful masterpiece.
That's not such a bad thing to think about.
No. All right, I'm going to open them up. Grab one, grab a handful.
I'll grab a handful probably. Listen to the box, the shake, the rumble. Oh, that's right. They're half. Oh, there's cute little. Ooh,
they've got
shit
characters.
I'm dropping them. There's a recipe on the back too. Do you take that back? I've got one on the floor.
And if you look at if you look at the faces, you can see whether it's grumpy, sleepy, hungry, cheeky, silly, or happy. Oh, you've already put one in your bloody mouth. All right, I better catch up.
Oh, shit. Grumpy and who? Sleepy, happy, and Larry?
And Larry. Curly.
Curly?
Doc.
This is an unprecedented... I didn't expect this to come out of the bag today. I'm just going to go straight in and say these are quite clearly like a 9.
Quite clearly a 9. Well, I'll tell you what. This one, I'm about to eat happy.
Mm-hmm.
And which is a coincidence because that's exactly how I feel about this biscuit.
That's no coincidence. That's,
I think it's a
that's just life.
It is a 9 out of 10. Look how in sync we've been recently. It's definitely a 9 out of 10 biscuit.
You know, one complaint though, it is quite warm today.
Oh, and gets on your fingers. Yeah,
it might be the warmest day we've had so far this summer, and it does the melt value on this is low. I've already got chocolate all over my hands. So, keep that in mind.
Yeah. So, tiny teddies, half coated in milk chocolate. 9 out of 10. The
beautiful.
Same score as the Premier Choc Chip cookies and the chocolate teddy bear biscuits.
Oh.
Which is interesting because they're both biscuits and chocolate.
I think
as opposed to a chocolate biscuit.
Look, I love chocolate teddy bear biscuits, but these are better than those.
Okay.
In my opinion. Actually,
that's
I wonder
enough.
If you had a large, like a teddy bear sized, because the teddy bear biscuits and tiny teddy biscuits are not the same biscuit. They're different.
The teddy bear biscuits that are covered in chocolate are also covered in dark chocolate.
That's true.
And these are the honey ones dipped in milk chocolate.
These are the honey ones dipped in milk chocolate.
I believe so.
Right. I would like to see a teddy bear sized tiny teddy, in which case it wouldn't be tiny. I'd like to see a large teddy half dipped in chocolate. Can we get that, Arnott's? Can we
Come
get a
on,
large
Arnott's.
A large teddy?
Do us a solid. Our new sponsor, Arnott's.
Wouldn't new? That, wouldn't what that do you be mean? Amazing? What do you mean new?
So if you're going to have these biscuits, enjoy them with Mad Max Fury Road, of
Definitely
course.
Do that.
But also with The Godfather, Goodfellas, Reservoir Dogs, and The Dark Knight, which all have a 9 out of 10.
Incredible. Thanks. They're going to be in the middle now for the rest of the show. Might have a little snacky poo.
This is a bit of a momentous episode for a few reasons. One of which is that it's a movie from the book. The book that started it all.
When was the last time we did a film from the book? Do we have any idea?
I could probably find out.
Joker, Tequila Sunrise, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Ocean's 8, 11, 11, Solo, Bloody Mama. Was Bloody Mama in the book? I don't think so.
I think that's why we watched it.
It wasn't in the book or it was?
I think we watched it because it was in the book.
So Bloody Mama, 20th of May 2018 could be the last time we watched a film from the book. And if you don't know what the book is, the book was gifted to us. Jordan's going to show it now for everyone to listen to. Flip through the pages. The book was gifted to us by a dear friend, long-time listener, two-time guest.
Something like that.
Will Duncan, who is coming back over summer, so we might do a three-time guest with him.
Or we must. We simply
he
must.
Gifted Jordan the book for Kris Kringle, nonetheless,
exactly
in 2015,
right.
The end of 2015.
Yeah.
Bit of Podfather history. And not but 2 months later, we had started a podcast based on the book.
We certainly had.
And we've somewhat abandoned the book. The book has been a saga, controversy, and also joyous fun.
Yes, we spoke to some of the contributors from the book.
Yes, we must get Michael back in touch Coven, with some of these people.
Well, I did actually reach out to the author of this this one.
Yeah.
But he unfortunately didn't get back to me in time or at all, depending on before when he gets back to me. Yes, Bloody Mama 1970 is in the book.
Fantastic.
Otherwise, we wouldn't have watched it, I don't think.
Well, and maybe also maybe not Key Largo.
And maybe not Key Largo.
Fantastic poster, by the way.
Well, there's a few of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't know if you're talking about this
one. That one,
yeah,
I like that
we're
one.
Talking about visual things on, yep. on an audio medium, but what do you think of the posters, folks?
Drop us a line.
1948, directed by John Huston, who also directed, I believe, The Maltese Falcon, which is one of my favourite movies of that era and right. probably my favourite Humphrey Bogart performance. So take that. There's a bit of personal...
Maltese Falcon.
Trivia. The Maltese Falcon. Oh, it's a great. It's one of those. He plays a detective. Oh, mm-hmm.
It's not a Philip Marlowe one. Maybe.
No, I don't think it is.
What?
But it's that kind of feel.
What other Bogart films have we watched? The Big Sleep?
Yes.
That's it, right?
No, we watched the one where they went to war with him and Jimmy Cagney.
Oh, that was great, that one. What was that? Wasn't the Roaring Twenties, was it?
Yeah.
Angels with Dirty Faces. No, the Roaring Twenties.
The Roaring
Twenties. We haven't done Angels with Dirty Faces, have we?
Yes, we did.
We did?
Yeah, we did that over the phone. But yes,
did I watch that one at the cinema? I think I did. Yeah, I think I watched that at the cinema.
I've watched that in the cinema as well. The Roaring Twenties.
The Roaring Twenties.
1939.
Yep.
With so this is a James Cagney as the headliner and then Humphrey Bogart underneath the title.
Ah, yes, right.
He wasn't
now,
big yet.
Oh, in this decade since then, Bogey's yep. obviously become the hot fuzz.
Bogey and Bacall, both.
Yes. Are they married at this point in time, 1948, 49?
Yes. And this is their fourth and final film with the pair.
Ah.
They did a television project afterwards, I think.
Right.
One of those, you know, Netflix things or something. Well, that's where the money is now.
One of those Netflix.
Yeah, the fourth and final film. The Big Sleep was the second one. And, yeah, they're married at this point, I believe.
They didn't stay married, though.
He had ailing health. Didn't she nurse him throughout his ailing health?
Well, and then he passed away.
Yeah, because he was a bit older.
Right. Should probably do a little bit of research prior to these podcasts.
I know we definitely did before the Big Sleep one. So if you want to actually hear about a bit of history of the two, listen to the Big Sleep episode or listen to a great podcast called You Must Remember This, which is about old Hollywood. And they do a great Lauren Bacall and Humphrey Bogart series of episodes
nice.
A few years ago.
Nice.
So listen to that.
Listen
shout
to that.
Shout out to that podcast. What did you think?
I wasn't terribly wrapped in this one, actually. Basically because, I don't know, I think it's interesting for us to watch these films. I think it's interesting for anyone to watch these films. I think it's really important for people to watch these films, these sort of older Hollywood films, you know, done on a soundstage, the black and white, obviously, 4:3 ratio, the, what do they call that? The Academy ratio, I think they call that.
That's I'll just thing. Let you sit in this
I think,
one. I don't know.
I think that's a thing. Because they are a totally different world. And in many cases, they're an amazing world.
Some of our favourite films
yeah.
have been from pre-1960.
Yes. Yes, exactly. No, 100%. And, you know, there's something about them. And there's a lot of things about this film that I love. But ultimately, I felt that it didn't really draw me in that much. It had a really great sort of climax and then ending. I liked the sort of maybe second, third of the film probably.
Yeah.
I liked, but I think that the part of the problem is that when you're watching something like this that is, of course, dated, I mean, we don't make films like this anymore. I wish that we did do more stuff like this in a creative way.
Yeah.
Because it would be really interesting, but I think that there's an element of it being dated, and if it doesn't really draw you in, then you're probably not going to go along for the ride. At being in our generation.
Yeah.
And part of that is sometimes you can just watch it in the wrong mood, you know. And a big part of that actually, which I wanted to mention, was the actual experience of it. Because as soon as this film started, it's got an amazing sort of orchestral overture, which is obviously what they mostly all had at the time.
Yeah.
The opening
Warner
credits.
Brothers. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was instantly taken back to actually being at the Prince Charles Cinema when I was working there. And there was a couple of films like Angels with Dirty Faces, a Hitchcock film called Rebecca, It's a Wonderful Life, they're probably the highlights of those sort of older films that I watched in the cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just something about it that it's like, I feel like if I was actually in a cinema, I might have enjoyed this film more.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they are made for that experience more than probably Marvel. Marvel movies are made to watch on your Apple TV now, you know? Like, yeah, it's better in the movies, but these ones are just constructed in a way where you need to be locked in,
yeah,
and just watching it and taking it in. You can't be sitting in the living room with, you know, a small screen, and I was watching with mum and dad and they started talking and buffing their, like, Bogart knowledge, and I was like, I'm trying to watch the damn movie.
Well, if you maybe paid more attention to that, we wouldn't have seen, like, such idiots at the start.
Well, that's true. So that's kind of my sort of introductory summary.
Yeah.
I think. What did you think?
Well, I think I agree with you because, likewise, I've seen Angels with Dirty Faces at the Astor.
Yeah.
I saw it with a double bill with Maltese Falcon, actually.
Oh, fantastic.
It was incredible, which I've seen at the cinema twice, that movie. And I don't know that if I watched that movie like I watched this movie, that I would have had the same response to
it. Did you watch this on your laptop?
I watched this one on my laptop.
Yeah, yeah.
Having a look at our scores for both Angels with Dirty Faces and The Big Sleep, our other two Bogart movies, they're way down the list. They're sort of in our bottom 20
right
films out of about nearly 60. So, but we still think of them fondly.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Yeah.
And I think this one, I probably feel similarly. The Big Sleep, I quite liked that. That had a quite action-packed last third as well from memory.
Yeah.
Shootouts galore. It seems that that's a bit of a structure. You spend a lot of time in these soundstage locations. There's some tension and some, hey, what are you doing, huh? And then all of a sudden
wise guy.
A character like shoots something or something goes awry and they're on the run for whatever reason.
Well, and those sort of moments are far more impactful in these films than they are in some new films, in my opinion.
Oh, I agree.
Because they do a really good job of this. This film is essentially one set.
Yeah.
I guess there's the intro, which is on a road, then there's the hotel set, and then there's a third boat location.
Yeah.
It's like three locations, but one location basically.
Yeah.
And
it felt like The Hateful Eight in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well,
as in, and it felt like Tarantino was trying to replicate this sort of feel when he made that movie.
Funnily enough, Mum was researching. I wasn't doing any research because I'm not a very good host, but Mum did a bit of research, and apparently Key Lago was a play first.
It certainly was a play.
So actually, Hateful Eight's a really good parallel, I think.
True. Well, quite a different play though. They changed a lot of things about the play. We'll talk about the plot a little bit. So Humphrey Bogart plays an old soldier, an ex-soldier who's back from the war and gone to visit the family of one of his dead friends. The father, played by, is it Lionel Barrymore? I believe so.
One of the Barrymores, yes.
Yes, Drew Barrymore's grand-uncle.
Grand-uncle.
Yep.
And he's kind of got that face.
Yeah.
You can tell.
The Barrymore face.
The Barrymore face.
Yeah. And also the widow, played by Lauren Bacall, which is interesting because there's not really a romance between the characters, although it's maybe implied.
I think it's quite implied.
Also, I think it might only be implied
for the sake
so
of
heavily
it.
Because of what we know about their relationship off screen.
Right.
Because there's no like actual romance. It's more of a...
you think it's a retrospective feeling that we have?
Oh, no, I think it was played for that in the film,
yeah.
But I don't know that it was written like that, if that makes sense.
Like in the play.
Yeah, I don't know that the content between those characters is enough to be called a romance on its own.
Yeah,
but without everything that we bring to it.
They played it that way because that's what they were playing into. It's Bogie and Bacall. It needs to have some kind of a, you know.
Yes.
Well, that's actually possibly, not to jump ahead, but, you know, it is a bit odd that she very quickly seems to care so much about him.
Yes, absolutely. Basically, he goes to this hotel in Key Largo, but it's the hurricane season. So no guests, but there are some guests.
Ooh,
some shady characters wearing fedoras and thick ties. I wonder what they could possibly be. And there's also a singer. Claire Trevor plays Gay something. A singer? And she's also at the hotel. There's another guy that gets shot.
She likes the horses.
She does like the horses. And she's a big drinker. Woman after our own hearts. and weirdly, she was drinking tequila sunrises the whole time, which is...
Well, no, she wasn't.
You could tell from the way the grey changed from dark grey to light grey at the top.
You can tell from the... Oh, God.
Anyway, but it turns out there's a bunch of gangsters. Rocco is the leader of the gang. And he's based on Al Capone, that character, who himself moved to Key Largo in the later years of his life and died of syphilis the year before this film came out.
Rest in peace.
So
cultural icon.
Then there's just a bit of he said, she said.
Now the guy,
what's going on in the middle? I don't know. They were talking a lot.
Yeah, there was a lot of talking.
And there were also like these Native Americans who were trying to shelter from the.
There were
some
Native Americans, which I think that they actually did. Look, the plot continues that, yeah, they have arguments. That it comes to light that they are there to kind of sell what ends up being counterfeit money to other gangsters. Johnny Rocco's kind of, he was out in hiding. He kind of came back. He's doing this deal. Then he was trying to get to Cuba. So I think it seems like he was trying to make a last deal or something and run away. But the best part of the movie is the way that Johnny Rocco's character, all his decisions impact everyone else, and it's kind of hard to explain without getting into the roots of it. And this might be one of the reasons to watch this film. You know, he's a bit of a mastermind, and everything happens once he gets involved. Everything starts to happen kind of because he's planned it, I think, in his head, mm-hmm. and that's why he's the mob boss or the crime boss kind of thing, although he's kind of on the run. So I think he's a really compelling character.
And he's played expertly by Edward G. Robinson.
Yes.
Who's known for his sort of shadier characters in these films. That's how his legacy, that's what he's known for. He was also in Bullets or Ballots, which is also in the book that we haven't...
I'd like to watch more of his movies, actually, because, he's a bit of a face of the gangster world.
And he's got this tough guy face, and but he was known publicly for his activism and his public anti-fascist stance during the Second World War, and he even donated, I think, up to $250,000 to various organisations.
That would have been a lot of money back then.
Yeah. I don't know if that's adjusted for inflation or not. I can't imagine it would be if he's, you know, big star.
Big star.
And he was in a couple of films with Bogey, but this is the first one that Bogey had top billing over him. So Edward G. Robinson is a star in his own right. And he owns this film, I think.
Yes, I think so too. No, 100%. I think that he really is the main... It's interesting that Bogey was built on top of him because... He's the main character.
Mm. Well, it's just because Bogey's the hero.
He's the hero, yeah. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, actually, this is probably a good time to ask you. I mean, what do you actually think of Humphrey Bogart as you know, as an actor?
Well, I think he's an excellent leading man. In the same way that now we've got someone like Tom Cruise who just is Tom Cruise in movies, but we love it. Mm. And... Because no one can do what he does. He's the action star.
Yeah.
I feel like Bogey does a similar thing in that he is on screen. He's got so much charisma.
Yeah.
It's a very different style of acting back then, obviously. So he can just say his lines like, "Hey, what are you doing, kid?" or whatever. You know, he's looking at you, kid, like he does in Casablanca. And great. That's instantly iconic. He's got the tall, dark and handsome thing going on. I love watching him. Not as much in this film, but there are a couple moments where he sort of, just with his words and his attitude, really picks apart Johnny Rocco, or so it seems at times. I quite like Humphrey Bogart, I will say.
I don't know whether maybe it was this film, and because I haven't seen a Humphrey Bogart movie since probably Angels with Dirty Faces. But
He wasn't in that, was he?
Was he? Did you say he was? No. What was the other one?
Oh, I'm maybe miss.
Roaring Twenties.
Roaring Twenties, yeah.
Roaring Twenties. Since that one.
Yeah, because Cagney was in Angels with Dirty Faces.
But also the Roaring Twenties.
And the Roaring Twenties,
because this is my point is that I keep seeing him now with, like, you know, up against Cagney, up against this Robinson guy. And, like, I don't know, I'm starting to think that maybe he's not really my guy from that era.
Okay,
yeah. Which I think is kind of interesting because he is so famous and, like you said, top billing on this film, sort of overtaking Edward Robinson.
Yeah.
But I really much preferred Robinson. And I think I much preferred Cagney when Cagney's been in movies with him.
Yeah.
Like, I guess I haven't seen that many Bogey movies, but I'm starting to have seen enough to kind of go, well, I'm not sure if I really get him or like him that much.
Well, watch The Maltese Falcon. But in that movie, he's the star.
Mm.
There's no other charismatic gentleman that maybe overshadow him, which is interesting, certainly. And then, of course, you've got Lauren Bacall.
Yes.
And with what she's got, she does a fine job, which is to say that she's just sad for a bit and then angry for a bit and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's okay. You know, I hope she enjoyed her time on the film. She didn't win Best Supporting Actress, though. Claire Trevor won Best Supporting Actress for this film, her one Academy Award win from her career.
For playing
gay. Even though there's a few nominations, yes. And funnily enough, John Huston sprung the singing scene on her on the day. She didn't know when that was going to happen. She hadn't rehearsed. And that's why she got this nervous performance, because she was in front of all these stars singing this song for the gangsters in the film. And anyway, she won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress.
That is actually a surprisingly uncomfortable scene, probably because of that.
Yeah, because of this classic tactic that directors use on their female stars. It's just true. Everyone's done it. Kubrick and Tarantino and all of these big names. They just go, lol, how's this? Try this one. Anyway, but that's quite an interesting little tidbit.
Well,
but
no, that is an interesting tidbit.
They're the only two women in the movie, though, aren't they?
Only two women in the movie, which, yeah, is what it is. But definitely, thinking about it from what you've said earlier about Bacall and Bogey, almost as if her character's just there to play into that, you know, oh, here's a Bogey and Bacall film.
Mm-hmm. If it had been anyone else in the movie, that character would have been nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting that she's on the post. She's, you know, third bill. And, you know, I guess they don't really do they do that these days in Hollywood as much? I don't think they do. Like, yeah, it feels like quite a for the sake of it role.
And it's not necessarily, it wasn't particularly meaty for her to chew on either.
No.
Whereas some people really like those supporting roles if there's something you can really mine in it.
I mean, it almost would have been better to just have her be the gay character and not have a daughter of the grandfather, of his mate, and just focus more on that, because that character was good. She had she was drunk, she liked the horses, she sung, she was instrumental in part of the story, you know, she called in on the other guys later on, whereas, yeah, the daughter character didn't really do anything.
She was just a bit sad about her husband and then...
Sad about her husband and then sad about Bogey.
It was nice to at least have another person on that side of the tension.
Yeah, that's true.
Lionel Barrymore's character... His name I can't remember, but he plays is he the father or the father-in-law?
Father of the George who died.
And then Lauren Bacall is the wife, the widow.
Yeah.
So he's the father-in-law.
Yes.
Of her.
Yes. Which was a nice little story. Like I kind of liked that part. I liked the fact that she, you know, went and stayed with him after he died and stuff like that. That was good. You're right. It's good to have someone on that side of the fence, but they could have had – there's quite a few threads in this film, and it would have been nice to have an extra thread for her.
Yes.
For something else to happen.
Yeah, except she got slapped around a little bit too.
Yeah.
And that was like, okay. Yeah. I mean, obviously it's shocking.
You know, maybe
as a plot point, it was like, well, that – Well, I'm still scared of the gangsters even
maybe
if
the gangsters
happen.
Like kidnap her and take her on the boat and Bogey's got to I mean, we're rewriting the movie now, but Bogey's got to get her back.
Well, yes. So then they're going to go to Cuba at the end of the movie. They're going to go to Cuba and they need to take Bogey because he's an excellent seaman. And he shows his prowess because they're like, why is he going with them? Blah, blah, blah. But Gay, hero of the movie,
right?
Take me with you. Steals the bloody gun, gives it to Bogey. Hey, he's away, and he uses his. Wait, hang on. I need to read you what the Wikipedia entry says about the climax of this movie. Out on the straits of Florida, Frank, Bogey's character, uses seamanship, trickery, and the stolen gun to kill the gang members one by one. There's no better way to describe it. Yes, he does use seamanship, trickery, and the stolen gun to do that. And that's quite an...
That's an enthralling
really,
scene.
Really good sequence.
He does it really well. He takes his time and he picks them all off.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. And I think back to Gay quickly, I really liked how she turned on them in the end, because I think the whole film sets up her being a classic gangster female trope,
yeah,
just following the boss around and not caring for herself or anyone else, just following the money and the alcohol. But she does actually, after the singing scene, she does turn on him, which is really good. We actually don't see that in many of the gangster films we've watched, particularly later years.
Yeah.
So it's really cool to have that, I think, in
this
film.
That's true. They turned her from the damsel in distress into a bit more of a femme fatale.
Yeah, no, totally.
But nonetheless, still like a drunken one. But no, but that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Because she subverts all your expectations. No wonder she won the bloody Academy Award, frankly.
Frankly.
Frankly. So that's kind of the story. If that interests you, go check it out.
Go watch it. Yeah. No, I mean, look, it was a good story. I did like the story. And yeah, good like one set piece type of thing. And one thing that these old films do really well is, you know, because it's a smaller shot, you know, the square ratio, when they pan around the scene and the characters are introduced, you don't get that on a wide angle.
Yeah.
Because there's a bit more mystery to it. It plays a little bit more. You know, there's a guy reading the newspaper. There's a lot of these interactions. It's a bit more like a
Cluedo
thing.
It's easier to do it in one take than it is to set up the camera multiple times.
Yeah.
And it just means with those, I think anytime you put constraints on a filmmaker or an artist, the choices are always, well, often so much more interesting.
Yeah.
And I think old movies are a good case of that, not just the way things are shot. And there's not as much of this in this movie, but like special effects back in the day are infinitely more exciting when you know how they're done. Like the way Chaplin or Buster Keaton do their stunts. Yeah. Like, sign me up for that shit. It's all trick of the light or sometimes just physical ingenuity, or like playing the reel backwards or painting things on lenses. Like that to me is so exciting. And it's because they've only got limited tools at their disposal.
Well, and it's all practical. And actually, that was one thing that I couldn't stop thinking about watching this film was, you know, the fact that it was done on a soundstage, and particularly the scenes with the sort of dock and the boat.
Yeah.
They had a fucking pool in the studio.
Yeah, they had like a whole tank. Yeah.
That's insane. Like, when you think about that now, it's like, wait, so they all rocked up to work, went into the studio, and then there was this huge pool. Because there's one part where you can see the water brushing up against the backdrop, which is not a criticism, but it's more of a like they actually went to all that effort to fill up a soundstage with water and float these boats. I mean, the industry was crazy.
Even like 12 years ago, they were doing that.
Yeah,
for the big budget. Like to talk about Pirates of the Caribbean briefly to illustrate this point. When they made the second and third one, they built everything on a soundstage, like huge, like real ships, but they had like real weather and all that sort of shit. And like they built so much of it. If you look at the special features of the fifth one, it's just like half a dinghy in a blue room. Like,
And
it feels different, like, because there's no real water and stuff, you know?
No, 100%.
Or they
right.
go to the ocean or whatever.
Yeah. And that's a huge, I think that's a huge issue that we're really balancing in Hollywood, especially since the advent of digital effects. You know, some people are balancing it really well, like your Nolans, and other people are just crunching out budget cheap movies.
Theme parks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, it was Lionel Barrymore. I want to talk about him a little bit more.
Yeah.
He was actually wheelchair bound at that time, mostly.
Really?
His arthritis was really bad. So that meant that the scene, he gets up and has a go at the gangsters at one point, folks. And it's quite a powerful scene, but it's actually even more powerful when you know that he was, that would have been a lot of effort.
Yeah, for that man. For sure.
And he died a few years later. Poor granduncle Lionel. What did you think about the music?
Oh, awesome, actually. That was one of the good parts.
Max
like I said.
Steiner did the music.
Yeah, the overture in the beginning really sort of drew me in.
Yep.
Whether that's just because that's what those old films are like, or if it was particularly good, and then it was actually quite like A lot of it was quite unsettling, the music. Again, you know, I guess it's hard sometimes to know because haven't seen heaps of these films, but there was that was part of that experience that I was talking about that I think, you know, definitely got lost through the ages for a variety of reasons. But the music is like a real beast, I think, in this film. I think it's just that first half of movie making, the first 50 years or so or whatever, it was just a different marriage of sound and vision. Like I was watching, have you watched Watchmen yet? Or are you going to watch Watchmen?
Is it on HBO?
Yes.
Then I shan't.
Well, you should try and watch it somehow. But there's a scene in the opening episode, the first part, because it flashes back to like the 20s, I think, or earlier. And there's a movie theater and someone's playing the piano live in the movie theater, which obviously is how they used to do it. And from that era right through to this film, like the way the music is actually used is, I feel like it's a lot more acute. It's a more part of it. It's really emoting what's happening. Coming from the silent era, I think, it carries over.
There's little moments like someone will get punched in the face and there'll be a huge like,
yeah, it's a bit more.
Now that would be so on the nose, really.
Yes.
But to do it then, you watch it and it's just part of it. Or like someone will say something and there's almost that like, it's not quite that overt in this film, but there are moments like that where the ominous music is classically ominous.
Yes.
And like now it would be cliched to do it, but it works in this film.
Yeah.
And married with the sound design, which I thought was excellent because they're in this hurricane and so you can hear the raindrops and you can hear the wind blowing in such a way that it feels dangerous, but not, it doesn't overpower the scenes. It enhances them, I thought.
Yeah.
And like even just how do you convey heat in a black and white picture? That's something I was thinking about.
Just give the chubby guy a sweaty upper lip.
Yeah. And it's sweat and it's moisture and it's unbuttoned shirts. And like that's on a soundstage. They were probably all very, very comfortable.
Yes, yes.
If, I mean, it might have been a little drafty in there even, but they all look like, and you just have to show a fan being on and that's it. And I guess you have them complaining about the heat a whole bunch too.
A lot.
But, you know, that stuff's really interesting to me.
No, I agree with you. And it's like, I think it's like a weird, again, I guess this ties in with the visual effects and the way that things are done now, but it's a weird paradox where it's like, you know, that film is so fake because it's on a soundstage, but there's something about that particular brand of fakeness that feels comfortable and real.
Yeah.
Versus watching someone or a film, sorry, that's been shot 80% on a green screen.
Yeah.
And whilst that, people feel that maybe is more real. It's just not more real.
There's an authenticity
to
a practical way of doing things, even if it might be, it might feel cheap or fake or look not as visual, like photographically real, let's say. But there is something you can sense about it.
Photo realness, I think, is like a real trap that we constantly get stuck into in video game industry, in the film industry, like,
and it's so boring.
It's boring, and it's kind of like, you know, there are some things that work really well being photoreal, but actually, give me a movie with a little bit of artistic license any day of the week. Doesn't have to be photoreal if the effects look better. Do it, because we're meant to be in an imaginary land anyway.
That's
most
true.
Of the time,
that's
even true. even if it's a, like, you know, that's the thing about this film, like it's all real, meant to be a real hurricane, meant to be a real hotel, but like it's a movie, it's still fake, like that's part of it. And these old soundstage movies do that really well, actually. And you know, part of it's because they were churning them out like crazy, they were developing all these really good techniques, they had it all under control, it works really well. But yeah, we need more music like that too.
I think so too.
Did we want to consult the book?
Yes, well, that's why I brought it with me. The entry for Key Largo in the book was written by Dr. Russ Hunter, who has written a couple of books about like pulp cult cinema, rather.
Sure.
And also the cinema of Dario Argento, who did the original Suspiria.
Yes, which I still need to see.
So he's clearly into cult cinema. So I wanted to ask him a little bit about that, and it's a shame that he wasn't able to get back to us in time. But he,
well, if he does, we'll include it. Has he done? Do you know if he's done any of the other movies we've watched?
No, No, I've flicked through the book a little bit, and I couldn't even really see his initials anywhere else. I need to have a more thorough scan. But he likes to say that Key Largo is a far less conventional gangster movie than this summary suggests, and because he's just given a summary of the film. And much of its interest lies in the way Houston and Brooks being, of course, the screenplay writer, along with John Huston, who directed as well, managed to exploit the codes of action, dress, and character to make a highly competent addition to the genre while simultaneously endowing situations and dialogue with dimension determined by the immediate post-war situation. So I think that's pretty interesting, is that without showing the war like the Roaring Twenties did or something like that, whereas the Roaring Twenties was about an earlier war, of course, this movie came out in 1948. This movie is like fresh.
Yeah.
The people go into the cinema to see this movie, and I think what Dr. Hunter has brought up here about the post-war stuff is really interesting, because the cinema-going audience, when they saw this, had their mates die in the war and probably had to go and visit families in much the same way that Frank had to in this.
Yeah.
So to give them a bit of a gangster, how's your day going situation.
A bit of a run-in.
Like, you know, imagine you're thinking, oh, I have to go and send my condolences to Jimmy's family. That's going to be tough. But I just saw Key Largo and it's not going to be that tough. So so maybe, you know, maybe it's going to be okay. You know, maybe that's something to think about too.
Well, no, I think that's really actually a really good point. Something that we probably don't consider as film reviewers, and also just as people. I don't think our generation, when watching older films, doesn't always actually respect the context, which is a big deal.
Yeah.
The context of when it came out, what was happening at the time. Yeah, we're not going to understand that sort of idea of going and visiting your war mates' friends.
No.
Which we should probably try and understand that a little bit more. Whether that's relevant to us these days, maybe not. We're lucky, I guess. It makes me think a little bit of Peaky Blinders, which after we talk about The Sopranos one day, we should definitely talk about Peaky Blinders one day. That is a whole show that is actually set in between World War One and World War Two, and it's one thing that it does really, really well is gives you a lot of context for what it was like to live, particularly in the 20s, and now they're getting into the 30s in the show, the most recent season. But to live through the 20s after World War One, it's a world that we have no comprehension of, and Peaky Blinders does a really good job of showing you that through the lenses of the Peaky Blinders themselves. So, you know, I think that's really, really important to consider.
Yeah. I'm going to read a little bit more from Dr. Russ Hunter. You can keep as much of it as you want because I'm finding this very interesting to talk about. And I'm talking about not just the personal situation of the post-war, but also the societal situation. And they've just fought the Nazis. And like I said about Edward Robinson being quite an important figure publicly about anti-fascism and stuff. So to have him in this movie is interesting, and I'll keep reading. This is achieved by a careful articulation of the twin themes of war and the struggle against fascism, going back to the 1930s, and the corrupting influence of gangsterism in both real life and the cinema. Only the previous year, John Huston had founded with other Hollywood personalities the Committee for the First Amendment to combat the attempt by the House on Un-American Activities Committee to investigate communism in the film industry. So these are really like politically charged times. Key Largo subtly shows the shift within Hollywood from an anti-fascist consensus toward one where new Cold War alliances excluded as hostile to corporate interests, any commitment to the values that united Americans up to 1945. Those in Hollywood who worked closely with gangsters throughout the 1930s to break unions and who felt that standing up for civil rights of such undesirables as African Americans and Native Americans was synonymous with communism found themselves in charge again after the war, facilitating witch hunting. This is all I don't know how interesting this is to everybody.
No, well, I think that gives a lot of context to the film, basically. Yeah. That there's a lot of those things that they touch on.
Yeah, so the victory of Frank McLeod is both wishful thinking on John Huston's part and a tribute to a now lost commitment to those progressive values symbolized.
They one thing that they mention quite a few times in the film is that they think Prohibition's going to come back,
yeah,
which I thought was quite an interesting thing. But no, that's interesting. It reminds me of, what was that film? I don't know if you saw it. Clooney was in it, and it was about, I think, the film industry in the 50s, and what's his name who played Solo was in it. That was one of his first roles.
The Coen Brothers movie, Hail Caesar.
Hail Caesar. Doesn't George Clooney play a communist in that?
Yes.
So that must be what that's kind of based on, that era of like the film industry. And then, that was a very, very funny movie. You got George Clooney who has like a communist meeting in his house. And that's actually just giving me a bit of context for that film, actually. Because I thought that was a bit of, in that film, I thought that was just something ridiculous that they had George Clooney do. But actually, it's probably based on more
what
real.
What's happening in cinema.
What's actually
Hollywood.
Happening in the industry.
Mm.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And also, another thing that happens in the play that it was based on is Frank dies, that character.
Right.
In the play. In the movie, he's the hero. So, anyway, pretty interesting.
I think when you actually
think about the history of it.
Yeah, well, I wish we might have led with a little bit of that at the beginning.
Yeah, if you've stuck around to this long.
Let's give it a score. That's actually been quite a fun movie to talk about, despite the fact that
it wasn't as engaging.
I didn't really enjoy it that much. Yeah. Mm. Like, I'm happy about this. I think that's something that, I mean, maybe it's just because we're film nerds and we like the history, but I think that for older films or retrospective things, like, you know, like it's shit to go and watch a new film and have it be bad and then talk about it. It's kind of boring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if we talk about an old film that it happens to be bad, there's still like all of this juicy thing stuff to talk about, which I kind of like.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like I thought about Bob Le Flambeur a bit last night as well, and how that was obviously, you know, such a different film and how we have rated that so poorly, but I'd love to watch that again.
Yeah. Well, when I was flicking through the book this morning, I saw a Japanese film from around this time that I would think would be super interesting to watch.
Hell yeah. Let's do it.
Let me tell you what it's called. Let me tell you what it's called, baby. Can't find it. Anyway, a Japanese film that I thought might be cool to watch because, you know, that's a whole other cultural cinema-going experience that we could discuss and try to figure out. Maybe if we don't like the film, well, why is it in the book and all that stuff. All right, let's give it a score. I'm thinking I liked it, but I wasn't, like you said, I wasn't super engaged by it.
Yeah.
Apart from key moments or key Largo moments. I think, so it's better than a 5, maybe not as good as a 7. I'm going to give it a 6.3.
I'm going to give it like a solid 5.75. No, 6. 6. 6. 6.
All right. So that means that it's got a Podfather score of 6.15. Now,
thrilling. That feels good.
6.15. This is the only movie with that.
I love it when we reach new territory with the scores.
Yeah. 6.15 puts it below Solo, A Star Wars Story on 6.25 and above Public Enemies with 6.125.
Public Enemies is the Johnny Depp one.
Yes, the John Dillinger.
Yes,
film.
Which I hated.
Well, there you go.
What did you give that?
Obviously higher than you did. Because I quite like that movie, but it is quite slow.
Well, for context now,
the other movies of this era that we've watched, The Big Sleep got 6.5, so a little bit higher. Angels with Dirty Faces got 6.7, a little bit higher again. The Roaring Twenties, on the other hand, 7.45, so that's much higher. And then, of course, we've got the classic black and white film that's got a best score is Scarface, The Shame of a Nation.
It's quite interesting because Scarface was an interesting one because I feel like, I mean, there was a lot of, one of my memories of that is there's so many like car shots out on the field kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's funny how the industry did. I think there's definitely, maybe it was the 40s and 50s where they really somewhat settled on this soundstage idea.
And it's so much easier to make a movie like that.
Yeah. And I think that that's kind of fascinating. And then I guess that was, you know, obviously as we've seen movies like Bonnie and Clyde and The Godfather, they really broke out of that. But I think it's an era that we need to do a little bit more watching of and kind of exposing to our young and lovely audience.
Yes, because we have this, listeners, we have a bit of a dilemma with when it comes to these. We really wanted to watch this movie because we haven't watched one of these movies in a long time. However, we know based on the stats that we get that the episodes where we're doing much more iconic movies, newer movies, get a lot more listeners. So for those of you who have listened to this whole episode so far, please let us know if you've enjoyed it, and do please let us know if there's any other movies from this era that you'd like us to do. Because because if we know people are going to listen to them, of course, we've enjoyed this conversation regardless, frankly, if none of you are listening.
We'll do it anyway.
But to trying to figure out the balance of newer films versus older films, please let us know if you like us talking about the 40s and 50s.
Yeah,
Because I know when we watched The Lavender Hill Mob.
Oh, yeah.
My friend, I think it was Alana, who talked to us about the one that's in New York now.
Yes.
She messaged me, I think, after that and said that she'd seen the film after we talked about it.
Fantastic.
So if that ever happens, please, listeners, let us know.
If you make it to this point of an episode where we are rambling about how you should talk to us, stop what you're doing. Just hop on Twitter, go at the Podfather Pod and say, hey, guys, listening to Key Largo, awesome job. I'd love to hear more about Bogey, or I'd love to hear more about, you know, 50s, 40s, 50s sound stages. I'd love to. You know what? I hate this, actually. You should fucking watch cool movies. What are you doing watching classics, you dicks?
Yeah.
That's for old people. That's fine, too. Just let us know. We want to know. Just and leave us an review on iTunes while you're there, all that stuff. We're here. Please.
And we've got some very exciting episodes coming up in the pipeline.
We've got a whole bunch of things happening, actually.
So, we're, you know, we're well and truly back.
One thing that I wanted to bring up, actually, I remembered after we did the intro, which maybe we might bring this up again next time. Did you hear about Benioff and Weiss?
Oh, leaving Star Wars.
Leaving Star Wars.
I'm actually glad you didn't bring it up in the intro. We can talk about it now. And if you don't want to hear about us talking about Game of Thrones and Star Wars, we'll see you next week. Well, next fortnight.
See you next fortnight.
Yeah, I'm so glad that they're not doing it. I don't want them to ever do anything again. And also, you heard that the Naomi Watts Game of Thrones prequel got cancelled too?
Really?
I believe.
Right, yeah. Okay. Like, was that a movie or a show?
It's going to be a show.
I think that they're rolling with one of the shows, though.
They're rolling with the Targaryen.
The Targaryen one.
I believe.
Just, like, tell a new story, honestly.
Yeah.
Look, I think one thing that's really interesting about this, though, is that, like, I mean, like, I don't know if it can be seen this way, but it's almost like a win for Netflix versus Disney. Because I know that they had, like, I think, look, they've said, what they've said is that, you know, there was a prearranged deal with Netflix. They didn't think they could do both projects justice, which is probably true. I think there's probably an element of maybe they experienced the backlash after Game of Thrones and they might have actually made a wise decision to not tackle another big franchise.
A Benioff and Weiss decision.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's a case to be made that, like, you know, Netflix has secured what were the two hottest writers, producers, directors, or whatever in the business over the last 5 years or so.
And they've already got Vince Gilligan in their pocket too.
Well, yes. And Scorsese.
Yeah.
And fucking who else? So it's interesting, I think, in that context, because you'd think that Disney would just throw them more money or whatever, but
Or Disney doesn't need to do that. They've got the Lizzie McGuire reboot happening.
I think it's interesting to see what does happen now with Star Wars, though, after we should do a little bit of a Star Wars recap at some point too. Get Liam back in.
The Rise of Skywalker. Yeah.
Anyway, that was the last little bit of thing I wanted to bring up.
Yeah.
Fascinating. The movie biz.
The movie biz, of which we are merely spectators.
All right. Well, see you next time. Drop us a line.
Thanks for listening.